Welcome to another installment of the Major Spoilers Podcast. This week, we've got two episodes, Zach on Film out this week, but we've got a special treat for you. We've got Chris Roberson over there at Dynamite Entertainment has written the first issue of The Man of Bronze. Doc Savage came out this week. We're going to do a cover-by-cover or page-by-page director's commentary, if you will, of the issue. So, Chris, thanks for joining us, taking the time.
Well, happy to do it.
All right. So, first question, the cover, Alex Ross, wonderful. Do you get to throw in any comments, suggestions, et cetera, or does Alex just say, here you go, kid?
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, for example, I've been working on The Shadow for a little while and did Masks.
Mm-hmm.
And in those cases, basically, I would give Alex a description of the basic plot or maybe like some thematic elements, and he would just take it and go do something. But there's much more of a collaboration on these covers. There is a whole lot more back and forth. So we've gone, but there've been a few notions before this idea was hit upon, which was fairly early on. The pencil version of this cover was done by July. It was pretty early on.
Oh, okay.
There was a kind of like feedback loop where I would suggest things that he might include in this kind of layout, and also things he included, I decided to incorporate into future stories. So for example, the in the lower right-hand corner, you see this group of characters that we don't know.
Yes, that's what I was just going to get to, because I just was noticing that going, holy crap, is that? Wait a minute.
Yeah, like who are those people?
Yeah.
And the thing is a very similar lineup, virtually identical with a few minor tweaks, was in Alex's first pencil rough layout.
Mm-hmm.
And he said they were just placeholders and, you know, we could replace them with whomever. But my notes for later aides and associates were pretty rough at that point. And so I said, no, I'll just use this as a starting place. If you can change this character slightly this way and do this thing with this character, I'll just base it around those guys. And so that is the 2013 Doc Savage crew.
Oh, excellent.
Like
I was curious because you got a guy that definitely looks like he's a throwback to the late 60s and then someone all in spandex. And it's very, when I caught that earlier, I was like, holy crap, we're actually looking ahead, not just a throwback, because in the upper left-hand corner, you have the crew as they were in the 1930s. And then down in the lower right-hand, it's like, we are going through time in this cover.
Yeah. And also the jet was something that Alice had suggested, you know, kind of a late 20th century successor to the various Hidalgo trading company aircraft.
Oh, yeah.
But also on the upper left, you know, you see Doc kind of more in a Bamhoffer look. We could talk about this in a minute, but one of the directions that I gave to Bill Quisevoli, the interior artist, was that in this first issue, Doc should not be as physically imposing a figure. He's a younger man. He's more like a Clark Gable physically.
Mm-hmm.
And then as he ages into the James Bama Superman.
Excellent.
I did see a few reviews that were a little flummoxed by the fact that he seemed like a younger guy and he didn't seem as big and muscled. And I was like, you know, give us time. Let us put a few years on him and then he'll get there.
So this story is taking place in 38, 33. When is this story taking place?
1933, yeah. Okay, so it's basically set immediately after the events of the first issue of Doc Savage magazine, Man of Bronze.
Okay. So as we look at page one, we're getting a narrator that is, I'm guessing from what we learn later on, is someone that is recounting this from the far future, from 2013.
It's somebody from the present day looking back.
Yeah. Okay. All right. The other thing that kind of struck me as odd, I don't remember, and again, we talked last time when we talked Doc Savage, I don't remember him interacting with, you know, historical figures or people that were popular at the time, and yet immediately we're injecting Albert Einstein into this.
That was a kind of I wanted to establish quickly that I wanted to show in the first issue, with as little, hanging signs on things as possible, that Doc was both an intellectual and a healer, and not, if not a pacifist, then at least someone who really valued life.
Okay.
And I discovered that for a brief span in the early 30s, Einstein was at Princeton, at the Advanced Studies Institute, the Institute of Advanced Studies. And I just thought that would be the perfect shorthand to show Doc is a smart guy, to have Einstein impressed by his idea.
Oh, yeah. And we don't know what that idea is because you've taken the chalkboard behind and scratched it all out.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it's not important. What his findings here are actually not that significant. It's just one of his current projects.
When you write, and I guess depending on which publisher you're with, I don't know if you use the same style or if you adopt a different style, but how do you and Bill Questeveli work and communicate to figure out what you want on the page?
So the collaboration can differ from project to project, even within a single publisher. But typically what I do is I'll write down all the panel descriptions first and then layer in the text. And then but then I also put in the bottom of the document. It's a Word document. Mm-hmm. I put inline JPEG images for image reference.
Oh, okay.
So in the back matter of the Comixology digital exclusive version of the issue, there's actually a few pages of script excerpts.
Excellent.
And throughout it says, see below for image ref. And I'm finding that I do on average more image reference for a Doc Savage script than for any other comic I've ever done. I just finished writing issue 3 last week. It's a 22-page comic. The script itself clocked in at about 24 pages, 25 pages.
Wow.
Of single space text. And there are 17 pages of JPEGs of reference for everything. So in this issue, there's reference for all the locations. There's reference for fashion and for appearances and technology and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Oh, yeah, because we get to see Ham and Monk pop in right at the right time. Perfect, perfect introduction to get the Doc name in there. And of course, Ham is supposed to be this dapper guy. And I guess by today's standards, we would see a suit like that and may think a little differently.
But in the 1933s, he was the best dressed man in America, one of the 10 best dressed men in America. Whatever.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. We go on to the next page and we see Doc writing, on the sideboard like he is depicted oftentimes in the comics. Really great. You were talking about doing a lot of reference for the city, and this becomes a big issue later on in the story. But did you have to do a lot of historical research to find out what the layout of the city grid isn't going to change, but what the buildings were and what markers look like from certain parts of the city?
Yeah, so I spent a considerable amount of time finding photo reference from the period. So in the script were included black and white photos from the early 30s of what all these buildings and these areas looked like at the time.
Excellent. Are you familiar with this site called Shorpy.com?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, you should check it out because they've got these huge, it's just an archive of photos that people submit. And some of them go back to like the 1920s and 30s, black and white. And these things are off negatives that are like 5x7 negatives. Huh. And then you blow them up. You can download them in this super high resolution. It's fantastic to look at New York and Chicago and cities the way they looked back in the in that time period.
I'll definitely check it out. I'll tell you that Google image search has been an indescribable boon to the comic book scripter.
Oh, I'm sure.
I can't underestimate how much it has benefited us.
There is something going on in the upper atmosphere that's causing everyone to go nuts, and man, woman, and child, but apparently not animals in this case, or at least that's not what we're led on. I mean, Doc does his own experiments later on.
Yeah, I'll have to look at the page. I don't recall.
All right. Yep. Well, it's the one with the car turned over and people kicking and biting and fighting in the streets. Police are putting up barricades.
Like in Midtown Manhattan, you wouldn't have much more than like pigeons and maybe a few dogs and rats. So maybe the animals are going crazy, but who knows?
Yeah. And I also like how, because it is where it's located, that Doc's other aides are able to rush up quickly and say, hey, we're already here. Don't go in that barrier area. Rennie is already going crazy. Already went in there and is going crazy too.
Yeah.
Then let's see, a couple pages of fighting. Everything goes back to normal. And then we get into the 86th floor of the world's tallest building. I just love how no one ever, even in the books, would never reference the Empire State Building.
They never say Empire State Building. Never. And in fact, in Phil Farmer's Doc Savage's Apocalyptic Life, he actually goes to some pains to prove textually that it is the Empire State Building.
There wouldn't have been any other taller building at the time. Even the Chrysler Building would have been shorter.
It's the only thing it can be.
Yeah. Nice inclusion of the pig.
Yeah, we weren't able to get chemistry on the page yet. He shows up in issue 3. So somebody asked me in an interview if we were going to get both the pig and the monkey in. And I said, well, we'll get them there eventually.
Excellent. But some great art here. I really like, I don't mind a younger looking Doc because he was always younger than the rest of the crew. This would be after the Man of Bronze book, as you said. So
he's maybe around 30 at this point.
Yeah.
Early 30s at the oldest.
So then the other thing, I guess, that shocked me, and this was, I know this is something that we've talked about, is technology through the times. And I guess the next day when the Aurora starts causing people to go crazy again, everyone's walking around with these very small walkie-talkies. And at first I was like, oh no, don't tell me that they're bringing in, you know, cellular technology or something like this back in the 30s. And it was Doc. But then I thought, you know, walkie-talkies, if Doc Savage had his hand on it, they would be a lot smaller than the, you know, like the World War II phone walkies that you see in old archive photographs.
That's 1933 future technology. That is from the world of tomorrow that only Doc and his crew have.
Which I really, really like.
Yeah.
We've got mapping of the city. So I'm guessing, again, you went back, found old map references to...
I spent so much time looking for a map of Manhattan from... at or just before 1933. That was at least a couple of hours worth.
So where do you go? Are you doing everything via Google? Or are you going, you have to go to New York and go to any historical societies or anything?
Oh, no, I don't have the time or budget for that. It's all online.
Okay. So some interesting uses of these radio transmitters later that we'll find out tracking it down. Doc starts meddling in the lab, and we've got some cool things with the mice, and we discover that it's radio waves causing some problems. And then Doc needs to figure out a way to solve the problem. And by the time the next day arrives, I guess this is 3 days out, everybody's ready with the gas bullets or the mercy bullets.
Yeah. The issues won't have titles as such, but in my head, each of them is a pulp novel. And so they all have very kind of Lester Dent-esque names.
Oh, yeah.
So the name for this adventure is The Savage Hour.
Oh, cool.
And it's a week of days in which there's a savage hour a day. But then I decided not to ever use the title anywhere. So I think John Cassaday will be including the title for issue 4 on the cover in a kind of, you know, homage to the kind of pulp layouts.
Oh, yeah.
But otherwise, it just exists solely inside my own head. Yeah.
Well, that's a very cool title. I like that the mercy bullets are here. But I always thought that they were a rubber bullet with... the
I checked. That's the description here is actually drawn directly from one of the Lester Dent novels.
Excellent. Man, you've done your research in and out on this.
I take this seriously.
No, I'm glad.
Savage fan.
Believe me, I'm glad you do. Let's see. Who's that up in the tower? Is that Rennie watching the city?
No, that's a long time. Oh, so he's doing all the stuff. Yeah.
And I like I think you really captured each of the characters' unique voices in here, which is something that can be challenging. And it worked out really well going forward. And then we get to this reveal, the Chrysler Building, with our bad guy inside. And he doesn't have technology that looks like future technology in 1933. He looks like he's using 1933 technology.
Yeah.
And so there's something going on with him. But it's an interesting reveal, because at first you may be thinking, well, who is this guy? Is he one of Doc's friends? Because of the way the facial features kind of look a little bit alike. But then very quickly we realize that he's the mad scientist.
He's the mad scientist. They laughed at me at the academy, and soon I'll prove them all wrong.
Yeah, I thought that was great. And then we get to this moment where Doc realizes that they can block, if everybody wears their tinfoil hats, so to speak.
Yeah.
We can block the radio waves from drawing us crazy. And I love the goggles that he wears in the laboratory, and that he's very properly dressed for laboratory time. You know, it's not just regular clothing. I've got to put on the white coat and the goggles for everything that I'm doing.
But still with the tie on, because he's a gentleman.
He's very proper. But then the next day, and this is the part where I was like, oh yes, the next day when the Aurora pops out and Doc has outfitted everyone with their metal hats, Widow Peak time, or Widow Fro time.
Yeah.
Was that intentional to do it that way?
Yeah. So the reference that I provided was actually Merlin from the movie Excalibur.
Oh, yeah.
Which was exactly the look I wanted. And it's an oblique reference to Philip Jose Farmer's theory that the Doc's hair is actually a skull cap. There's a chapter in which Phil Farmer in Doc Savage's Apocalyptic Life cites any number of times in which Dent describes water beating on Doc's skin in weird ways, or saying something about how something was cold between his skins, and the description of his hat, of his hair. Mm-hmm. And the supposition was that, like, he is wearing a skin tight bodysuit of protected material.
Oh, wow.
And this doesn't privilege that theory as being true, but was just a little fannish nod to, like, the reason his hair looks like that on the bomber covers is because that's what that is.
Yeah. No, I thought that was great, and it'll be interesting. Are you going to, I don't know if you want to give this away, are you going to transition to that hair style in the future, or is it going to stay to the nice?
If you look at his hairline, both on the upper left corner of the Ross cover, but also Bilquis's drawings, you can see that he's kind of got that Widow's Peak underneath the swoop of his hair.
Okay.
And so as he gets older, he just starts wearing his hair essentially in a crew cut. And it kind of follows those lines.
Excellent.
So it doesn't get quite as dramatic as some of the bomber covers.
Yeah.
But it does get closer to that look.
Long time.
Than the matinee idol, style of the 1930s.
I thought that I like this hairstyle. Did you ever look up, last time we talked, I'd mentioned that Doc Savage 1/6 scale of figure. Did you ever go check that out?
I've seen it.
And it's cool because they have both faces and heads that you can pop off. Depending on what hairstyle you like. And, until I really realized, because again, I grew up just reading the Bama covered stuff, until I realized that he had a comb over, I just really like that comb over style.
Yeah.
So Long Tom realizes that, wait a minute, the phone call is coming from inside the building.
Yeah.
And of course, rushes out, and Doc and his crew are trying to help. And so then Doc has to go and investigate over the next couple of pages. And confronts the evil mad scientist. And then Doc does something that I thought was a little very Doc, where he tries to talk the madman down. But then the madman, I don't think he jumps. He slips, doesn't he?
He falls, yeah.
Yeah, and then Doc dives off the side and rescues him, and then whips out another gadget, which, if we talk about how Doc Savage influences Superman and how Doc Savage influences Batman, He's got essentially a batarang, a gun, a grapple gun.
He's got a grappling gun, yep.
That he'll fire off to save the guy. But the guy does hit his head on the way down. I mean, that's one of the things about the Empire State Building that, you know, people are always like, oh, people will jump off and commit suicide. There's actually all those platforms and the way the architecture that you're not going to hit the street very easily. You're going to hit a ledge. And
it
that's
gets
exactly
wider
what happens here.
Yeah.
All right. So they have to perform emergency surgery. And because this is a very big spectacle, Doc takes him to a normal hospital. And I like this is another thing that you and I talked with about before was that he didn't take him upstate to perform the wire up the nose trick.
Yeah.
Or as you say it here, the treatment.
Yep.
And
which he would have done had you know, they had not been in such public view.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second issue, we find out about the treatment and the college and everything.
Excellent. And then this ends, I think, very nicely with our unconscious mad scientist who we don't know his name. I don't know. It kind of looks like a little smile there.
Maybe. He's unconscious.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I think in the script direction, it was just, you know, he's unconscious.
Yeah. I also like the discussion, and again, bringing up the morals of Doc Savage in that last page, where Monk is basically saying, well, why would you save this guy? He's a criminal. You should have just let him go. And why risk your life? And then Doc says, hey, you know, we have this right, this duty to help people regardless of who they are. And I thought that was a nice way to tie that up and reinforce what Doc is all about.
Well, I had hoped that I would be able to get the entire oath in somewhere, but it just wasn't feasible with the amount of story that we covered and the amount of pages that we had.
Right.
But I at least wanted to mention that they had sworn an oath and get some of the most important language of it across. So that's what that's about.
Remind me, is this an ongoing or is this a limited series?
Well, it'll really depend on how it does. You know, Dynamite typically approach these things. They'll plan for a certain number of issues.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, 8. And then if it does well, we'll keep going.
Okay.
So,
all right. So do you think that you're able to get, I mean, you have to get your entire story told in the 8 issues, but are you finding it difficult to try and pack in as much Doc Savage history, lore, mythos, everything into this, as well as advancing a story forward?
Not difficult, I would say. It's problem solving. It's an interesting part of the challenge is to, you know, showcase different aspects of the character that I think are important. And the second issue, the one regret that I have about the structure of our story is that setting a story in 1933 means that we can't have Patricia Savage.
Right.
Because she didn't come on the scene yet.
Right.
And so we get a lot of Pat in issue 2, which is set in 1949, shortly after the events of the final Doc Savage magazine issue.
Excellent.
Of course, it wasn't Doc Savage magazine by that point. I think it was Doc Savage Science Detective or something like that. But yeah, so we get a lot of Pat in the second issue. And in the third issue, then everything goes crazy. So, yeah.
Cannot wait. I mean, and the plan is to jump every decade in this, in the issues. Is that
so? What will happen is the main action of each story will start moving ahead roughly a dozen years every issue. But then we'll start having flashbacks. Right. So we'll come back to eras that will be more familiar to longtime readers and also fill in the gaps in between as we advance the story.
Okay.
So each of the first 6 issues is essentially a standalone. It's the conclusion of a different adventure roughly a dozen years after the last one. But through flashbacks and discussions and things like that, we'll find out what has happened in the interim. We'll revisit the original guys. They're never going to go away in that they're always going to be there in the 30s and 40s. But we're also going to introduce new casts of characters gradually that will be with Doc in later eras. And so that going forward, ideally, if we were able to do more stories, we could do stories that took place anywhere along that timeline. So Excellent. We could do a story that starts in the 30s and then maybe jumps ahead to the 60s and then maybe jumps into the present day, or it starts in the 80s and flashes back to something that happened in the 40s. You know, really, there's any number of ways to do it.
Right.
So longtime readers shouldn't think that, like, there's, you know, that this means they're saying farewell forever to the original crew as the series progresses. It's just we're going to meet new people that we'll also be spending time with alongside them.
Yeah, I think that's going to be really interesting because, as you indicated with the cover, with the future, the present day team, that means that the others aren't there. And so I don't know if you deal with the passing of characters or if the characters actually pass or not of the other teammates. But that'll be an interesting...
I think that we are going to be relatively coy about that. Okay. In the third issue, Monk and Ham are still on the team, but they're older.
Okay.
Because it's a few decades on. There's a reference to Long Tom being in retirement, but like sending vital information.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it almost feels disrespectful to like have any of them die. So I don't think that'll happen.
Right.
I think that they will retire. And that'll be that, you know, like we'll come back to them when we can.
Sure.
The reason that Doc is able to remain vital for eight decades is actually something that will be directly addressed in issue 3 and will be hinted at in issue 2.
Okay. And I think you had said that this is tied into one of the previous, stories.
This picks up a thread that was introduced and then, you know, kind of put to one side in a Lester Dent novel. And for longtime readers, you can check it out. It's Fear K.
Yeah.
What Doc says at the end of Fear K is not true. Okay. Want to go back and check.
Okay.
But that'll all be made really explicit within the next two issues. And it becomes something that becomes a new, kind of driving motivation for Doc, because he basically feels that he makes a mistake. Without giving too much away, that's what happens in the course of the next few issues.
Excellent.
I
was going to say, so then if we're looking at what 70, 80 years, some of these characters would have to be over 100 if they're alive in 2000.
Well, yeah, we won't be seeing them again. Like, so basically I don't want to, you know, let's not put, you know, Rennie on stage, you know, as a decrepit guy, you know, needing an iron lung or anything, you know,
right.
They will remain on stage so long as they're vital, and can contribute, and then will gracefully retire off panel, when it's no longer feasible for them to be on the team.
I think that's a wise decision, because if you just said, hey, off panel, so-and-so died or passed away 5 years ago or whatever, you're going to eat up too much of your storytelling dealing with that. But at the same time, you're also going to make a lot of people angry.
Yeah. And that's completely unnecessary. I have no desire to do that.
Yeah. So you're pretty pleased with this first issue. I thought it was a solid issue. I really did.
Well, thank you.
It was not what I expected. Which is good, because too often times, you know, Doc Savage stories kind of started to fall into a pattern. You know, you knew by the end of chapter one, kind of what the big setup for everything was. This did keep me guessing, and I like the introduction of the mad scientist and the potential fallout from these actions. I thought it was solid, and I'm excited, and I want to read more of this in the future. So I hope that it goes on for a long time.
Well, thank you. I will admit that I'm very pleased with how it turned out. I've been pleased with all the work that I've done, basically on all the comics work that I've done.
Sure.
But this is a character that I have admired for a long time, and that means a lot to me. And so it was important to me to communicate in hopefully an entertaining way what I thought were the core qualities of the character. Hopefully that works for people that are longtime fans, and also, you know, introduces that character to people that aren't. But if it doesn't, at least I'm satisfied that I've done that. So
Yeah. No, that's perfectly understandable. And you know, you can't please everyone, right? There are going to be some people that are upset.
I absolutely know that. Yeah.
So have you heard then directly from any, I mean, it's only been a day since this book has been out at the time that this is being recorded. Have you heard from any Doc Savage fan societies or sites or anything, feedback from them, or has it just been through the comic book community feedback?
It's all been the comics folks so far. I've not heard back from anybody. You know, I've not heard any discussion from the any kind of pulp aficionados.
Okay.
So yeah, I don't know. The comics people by and large seem to like it. And I've had a couple of professionals, some of them fairly long established storied professionals, just write to me to say that they enjoyed it, that they liked it. So that was really nice.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to go over this. I know we went through it kind of quickly, but I didn't want to spoil too much for people who haven't read the book.
Yeah.
All the way. Because there's some really good dialogue in here that I really think captures the characters well. And there's some great action. You know, just this scene of Doc trying to save the madman is great. So people should go and check that out. Doc Savage number one from Dynamite Entertainment. Chris, another announcement came across either yesterday or today. You're going to write Sovereign for Image Comics. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Sovereign is for people that are well versed in the terms of literary fantasy genre stuff. It is a secondary world epic fantasy. It is, so what that means is it takes place entirely in an invented world, with invented cultures and languages and whatnot, and has magic and supernatural stuff and dudes with swords. It's being drawn by Paul Mabury, who was previously probably best known for Aqua Leung, but who's for the last year or so been one of the artists on Catalyst Comics for Dark Horse.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's a big, crazy story with masked undertakers and civil wars over contested thrones and magical powers and all kinds of craziness. And there's a few preview pages that are available online. And the first issue comes out in March from Image. And it doesn't quite look like any other comic out there.
That's
which
good.
Which was the goal.
Yeah. So, interesting, I guess, because you also own your own digital comic book company, and it looks like Edison Rex is doing really well, and the other stuff from that, why did you not go through Monkey Brain Comics for digital distribution first, as opposed to going right to Image?
I don't think one size fits all. Okay. And I'm really keen to explore other possibilities. So for much the same reason that Mysterious Strangers came out through Oni, mm-hmm. Which also happened after Monkey Brain, I wanted to try to do, because I think Image does fantastic stuff, and I thought it was worth a shot. Maybe it will reach a different readership than a Monkey Brain book would.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's an experiment. It's throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Well, I know we're getting more and more people interested in the titles coming out from Monkey Brain and from you. I know a couple of our writers have started to be converts and checking out those titles on a regular basis. So that's good.
Oh,
so
hopefully, good to hear.
Yeah, hopefully sales are going well for you. How many books are you working on at any one time? You said you just finished issue 3 of Doc Savage. You've got Sovereign coming out in March. What else are you working on? Besides, you got Edison Rex still going on at Monkey Brain.
I'm writing Aliens for Dark Horse, being drawn by Patrick Reynolds. At the moment, I think I've got 4 things I'm writing scripts for in any given month. A few weeks ago, it was 6.
Wow.
So anywhere between 4 and 6.
And so,
4 is a good number because I can do 1 script a week.
Yeah.
And 6 is a little bit much.
Is that how you approach it? Do you say, hey, this week I'm working on this book, this week I'm working on this book, or do you parallel stuff? Okay.
Well, you know, I'm always, you know, things are always kind of cooking in the back brain, but in terms of what I'm actually getting up and sitting down and doing research for and writing for, ideally it's 1 thing a week. When I'm doing 5 or 6 titles at a time, it means that I have to turn out 3 scripts every 2 weeks, which means that I have to finish one by Wednesday or Thursday, start another one on Thursday or Friday, finish it by Tuesday or Wednesday, and then start another one to finish by Friday, which there's something about the almost circadian rhythms of finishing a thing by Friday and starting fresh on Monday that gives a kind of psychological satisfaction to my work week that I don't have if work is unfinished on Friday.
No, I understand that a lot. You work out of the home, right? Or do you have an office that you go to?
Yeah, I work out of the house.
That makes it a little bit easier when you're done with that week. Then you know that you've got the weekend to just relax and do whatever you want, as opposed to
Well, no, then I have to do all the monkey stuff. There's no such thing as free time. When I finish scripting, I've got to go do formatting and layouts and promotional stuff for Monkey Brain. But it means that that's a very different kind of task. It uses a different part of my brain. So at the very least, I can relax the parts of my brain that are responsible for scripting and use the more mechanical parts of my brain that are responsible for messing around in InDesign or Photoshop or whatever.
But I guess the part of it too is, and I know exactly where you're coming from by no rest, no relaxation time off. But at least you probably have that satisfaction of knowing that, hey, I'm working 90 hours a week for me as opposed to 90 hours a week for the man.
Well, I'm doing exactly what I want to do. I try never to complain. Occasionally I will bemoan the amount of work that I'm doing. But it would be really uncharitable and ungracious of me to complain about the amount of time that I have to spend, working on dream jobs. So yeah, it's all things that I enjoy. So I don't mind at all. I spend most of my evenings doing interviews or press or promotion and stuff. And I spend my days writing scripts. And I spend my weekends doing various Adobe products. And it's pretty awesome.
Excellent. 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 So the next issue of Doc Savage, this is going to release on a regular monthly schedule.
Yeah, I assume so.
Okay.
I just got done proofing the lettered and colored pages of it earlier today, yesterday.
Okay, cool. And then Sovereign in March and Aliens and a bunch of other things coming out from Chris, so be on the lookout for that.
Yep.
So thank you again so much, and you have a great week.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
All right, thanks, Chris.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
Probably the easiest thing I've ever done. The medication comes in the mail and it's very easy to use. I've been able to live my normal lifestyle and I've lost 20 pounds already and I've never felt better. It changed my life.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.